Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this August 2009 installment of Science News Update. I'm your jet-lagged host for the evening, Jim Campanella. Why am I jet-lagged, you ask? Well, I've just returned from the American Society of Plant Biology Conference in Honolulu, Hawaii. I live on the east coast of the U.S., and a one-way trip to Hawaii is 12 hours. My wife and kitties accompanied me on my little sojourn, and I have now come up with a new definition of hell. That is, traveling for 12 hours in a small enclosed space with no escape, with a one-year-old and a three-year-old. I will not go into the painful detail. I will just tell you that if there was not a sky marshal aboard the airplane, a lynch mob may have been convened against us amongst the other passengers. I just find it ironic that to reach the paradise of Hawaii, I had to first run the hellish gauntlet of the trip itself. But we are not here to talk about my personal traumas. We are here to chat about science. I have a very cool story to report from the conference itself, but let me make some general overview comments about scientific conferences for those of you who are not in the know or never been to one. Essentially, a scientific conference is in many ways the equivalent of a science fiction convention. If you attend an SF convention, like Comic-Con in San Diego, you do not go there intending to lie out on the beach or surf. You have your own fan agenda, which involves learning more about SF, going to panel talks, watching videos and movies, chatting with other fans, etc. Well, nutcases like me who go to serious scientific conventions, even in a paradise like Hawaii, are there to listen to the latest scientific breakthroughs, talk to colleagues, present their own data to peers, and yes, even talk to vendors about the latest products. And, like the SF geek, a serious scientist is going to go to the talks and watch PowerPoint presentations on esoterica and spend minimal time on the beach or in the sun. Seriously, most of the time I was out swimming or on the beach was the evening, and I was not the only one. We are in some ways a very sad bunch, but that is what it takes to be a scientist. I cannot tell you how many of the speakers I heard actually apologized to their listeners for keeping them from the sunny climes outside the convention center meeting rooms. So there are a couple of things to note in plant science at the moment. One of the big ones, there seem to be many more genomes that are having their DNA sequenced. Wahoo! The apple? Sugar cane? Prickly pears? The pawpaw, of all things. For those of you unfamiliar with the pawpaw, it's a fruit common to the southern U.S. which tastes kind of like a cross between a citrus fruit and a banana, and has a texture kind of like custard. Most people have never tasted or even seen a pawpaw, although it is mentioned prominently in a song in the Disney animated film The Jungle Book, which takes place in India, where the pawpaw tree does not grow. Anyway, the researchers doing the pawpaw work insisted that the fruit was on the verge of becoming a major economic crop. That has yet to be seen, in my opinion. You may ask, why bother with this sequencing stuff? Well, there's a very simple answer. Money. If a crop makes money, then it can always be genetically improved, so it will make more money. For instance, if you can sequence a genome and discover some minor variations that can be tweaked to make the plant no longer susceptible to root rot from fungus, then you will make back your investment many, many times. Of course, from a scientific point of view, sequencing genomes is very important because of the basic genetic research it involves, even if we ignore the money issues. One of the most interesting crops being sequenced is Miscanthus giganteus. I believe the common name is giant switchgrass. The presentation that I heard on this grass was done by Dr. Stephen Barling from the University of Illinois. You may think this grass rather uninteresting, but it is now being grown as a source of biofuel, and a much better source than corn, by the way. The giant grass can be grown in places where food crops like corn don't grow. It grows to be 10 feet tall with a huge amount of biomass. And unlike corn, which is a valuable food crop, Miscanthus is only useful as an ornamental grass at the moment. I actually have some huge specimens out in the front of my house right now. Proposals for use of the grass as a biofuel have gone in two different directions. Some scientific groups have proposed using the grass itself as fuel because it is so big in its biomass. You can compact it and burn it directly as fuel like you would coal. Others have suggested using the grass to make cellulosic fuel or alcohol like we do with corn. In either case, a better understanding of the genetic makeup of the plant would go a long way toward optimizing its growth. One cool thing about the ASPB conference this year was that it was co-hosted by a whole series of other organizations, many of whom are on the Pacific Rim, like the Japanese Society of Plant Biologists and the Australian Society of Plant Physiologists. One of the most interesting of the co-hosts was the Phycological Society of America. What is phycology, you ask? Well, it's the study of algae. This may sound boring, but it does have some really interesting aspects. For example, I sat in a plenary set of talks on coral reefs and their interactions with algae. That doesn't sound like it would go in a very interesting direction, but you'd be surprised. The talk was given by an Aussie, Dr. Lawrence McCook of Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority. And it really grabbed my attention. The title of the talk was Coral Reef Resilience, Degradation, and Climate Change: The Role of Algal Ecology. Apparently, reefs are quite sensitive to changes in the temperature of the ocean around them. If the temp goes up a few degrees from normal, the reefs literally bleach. Usually a healthy reef can come back from this bleaching and revive itself to normal. If the temperature goes up higher than a few degrees, then the reefs bleach and die permanently. Apparently, whether you agree with the source of global warming or not, the temperature of the oceans has been increasing in the last several decades, leading to mass bleaching of corals. The real problem has not necessarily been with temps rising so high that they kill the coral outright. The problem has been with increases of just a few degrees. If that happens, the coral is bleached and would normally come back after a few months and revive. But what has been happening is that huge mats of algae have been growing on these sickly coral reefs. Normally, the reef is in perfect balance with the algae, allowing a bit of growth of the algae, and you could actually see this visually, but no more. When the reef is bleached and injured, the algae gets out of control and can cover massive areas of the reef. I mean, to many inches thick. You could have mats that are up to feet thick, depending on the type of coral that's present. Once they do that, the reef does not recover and pretty much dies off permanently. The basis of these alga growing really is a consequence of the bleaching. McCook makes this point, quote, "Our observations become critical in the context of climate change. Increasing severity and frequency of mass bleaching of corals means algal dominance becomes the norm for reefs. An understanding of ecology of reef algae is therefore a major priority, including the impacts of climate change on the algae themselves and algal effects on coral regeneration and recruitment," unquote. It is surprising sometimes what the secondary effects of an environmental change are. No one would have predicted the close interaction between the coral and the algal species could be so altered by just a couple of degrees of change in the water temp. Another presentation took me by complete surprise by taking a left turn completely off the highway of plant molecular biology. Let me explain. Dr. Winslow Briggs is the grand old man of plant photomorphogenesis. He's from the Carnegie Institute in Washington, and he gave a talk entitled "The Love Domains of the Phototropins: In Loyal Service to Photoreceptors in Bacteria, Fungi, Algae, and Higher Plants." Don't let that title fool you. It really is an interesting topic. Before you skip the rest of my segment and go listening to the main story of the evening, be patient for just a moment. There is a payoff here. Really. First, a bit of background. What is phototropin? Well, it may or may not be obvious, but plants are sensitive to the light in the world about them. They get their cues for growing and development from the intensity and quality of the light that falls upon them. Everything from the germination of seeds to the opening of pores on the leaves is affected by light. The blue light receptors in plants have been dubbed phototropins. Most of these fall into the chemical category of the flavoproteins. The flavoproteins mediate phototropism responses in higher plants. Phototropins specifically will cause stems to bend toward light and stomata to open. Stomata are, again, those pores on the leaves of plants. Also, phototropins are important in chloroplast movements inside the cells. They also mediate the first changes in stem elongation and blue light. Now, Dr. Briggs has been working for years examining the phototropin proteins and doing experiments to determine what part of the protein is actually responsible for this light sensitivity. He and his research group have found that these molecules all have a common structure. Here is a quote from Briggs. Hold your breath, it's a bit technical. Try to follow. Quote, all the phototropins contain two highly similar chromophore domains designated LUV1 and LUV2. Both use a flavin molecule, FMN or FAD, as the chromophore. The LUV domain is composed of 5-beta sheets plus alpha helices to form a structure tightly enclosing the ring structure of the flavins. Unquote. The upshot of that Turgid statement is that structurally there is part of these plant proteins that has been discovered that is light sensitive enough to turn the protein on and off. And this is called the LUV domain, LOV. So what? This seems like a technical detail that you, the layman, can certainly live without, right? Well, let's go on to the cool part then. Briggs also discovered, after doing a bunch of computer data mining experiments in genetic databases, that you can find the same light-sensitive structure in other organisms like algae and fungi. That's not really a surprise. We already know that algae are light-sensitive since they go through photosynthesis, just like plants. Even fungi we've known for quite a while are photosensitive, even though they're not plants. But Briggs kept looking and discovered something even odder. He looked in animals and found nothing, which is not that hard to believe. We are evolutionarily pretty far from plants, algae, and fungi. But when he looked at bacteria, he found a large number of proteins with that same light-sensitive LUV domain. Here is the quote from Briggs. Quote, in bacteria, we found that the LUV domain proteins are a diverse group with many different functions and include histidine kinases, cyclase phosphatases, and different kinds of transcription factors. Unquote. At first, Briggs was puzzled. The obvious question was, what the heck are light-sensitive domains doing in bacteria? Why do bacteria need to sense light anyway? Well, he got a bit of an answer to that. He started collaborating with a research group in South America, and that was led by Dr. Gaston Paris. And they study the bacteria Brucella. Now, Brucella is not a problem in the U.S. or most of Europe because we pasteurize our milk and cheeses. However, brucellosis is a problem where pasteurization is not the norm and raw milk is drunk, especially in isolated farm communities in places like the Andes. Brucellosis is characterized by profuse sweating and joint and muscle pain. It's a nasty disease and it's been recognized in animals, including humans, since the 19th century. It appears that there is a LUV domain in a Brucella histidine kinase. Now, kinases are proteins that are famous for being part of signal transduction in cells. That means that they literally are used for signaling inside a cell by attaching phosphates to other molecules. Briggs could not imagine what the light-sensing domain was doing on these bacterial kinases, so he did the thing any good molecular biologist would do. He mutated the gene so that it could no longer make a light-sensing protein. Then he put it back into the Brucella and tested to see if there was any change in the bacteria. Lo and behold, there was. It appeared the mutated LUV kinase was important for virulence. In other words, the mutated Brucella did not give severe brucellosis like its normal counterpart. The only conclusion that Briggs and Paris could come up with was that the light sensing actually played a role in just how virulent the Brucella infection became. In fact, a major medical observation that doctors have been seeing for years was finally explained. People infected with brucellosis often had what are called undulate fevers. That means that the fevers actually went up and down. Oddly, the fever goes up in the day and down at night. Now that we know about the existence of that LUV domain in the Brucella, we suspect that is what is happening with the fever is a direct effect of light. Light may be causing the bacteria to become more virulent during the day. Briggs has found that LUV domain in proteins of dozens of bacterial species, and in the process, he's opened up a whole new area of experimental biology that did not exist previously: bacterial photophysiology. In the future, you may be treated with a combination of antibiotic drugs for an infection, along with light, or lack of light for that matter. If you think all of that is absurd and that light could never penetrate far enough to affect a bacteria, just hold your hand up to a light bulb. The light passes through your hand, doesn't it? Your hand is lit up. It's not that hard to believe that light can pass deep enough into tissue to actually affect bacteria. I just realized this is not the first time I've heard about light in relation to infection. You may groan, but if you send your mind back to the original Star Trek series, remember the episode, Operation Annihilate? While on the planet Deneva, Spock is infected by an alien life form. It looks like a single-celled organism that flies, and it kind of resembles a brain cell. Remember how he's cured? By being exposed to intense blinding white light, though only UV was needed. By the way, despite what Dr. McCoy says, Spock potentially would have been just as blinded by intense UV as by the whole spectrum. I myself have seen lab mates debilitated for days by direct ocular exposure to mild UV light. Sorry, I got a bit sidetracked there. But isn't that cool? I told you it was worth it to be patient. I always think that it's amazing when you're studying one thing and your experimental results lead you in a completely different direction. I've got one quick update before I sign off, and it has nothing to do with plant biology. You may remember months ago, I was talking about life extension and what you needed to do to live longer. One of the stories I mentioned was caloric restriction, which seems to extend the life of mice. Because caloric restriction has not been tested on primates, there have been many naysayers who have said that it probably won't work in humans, or monkeys, or apes to extend life. Well, it appears that they are wrong. Doctors Ricky Coleman and Richard Weindruck, both of the University of Wisconsin, just published their findings in an article in the Journal of Science a couple of weeks ago. Their 20-year study found that rhesus monkeys fed a nutritious, low-calorie diet have fewer age-related diseases than counterparts on a normal diet. The study began in 1989 with 30 adult male monkeys. In 1994, 30 female and 16 more male monkeys were added to boost statistical power. The monkeys were 7 to 14 years old when they entered the study. Since rhesus monkeys live on average 27 years in captivity, it has taken this long to determine whether cutting calories by 30% would fend off aging and death. Over the course of the study, monkeys on the full calorie diet were 3 times more likely to die from age-related diseases than monkeys that ate 30% fewer calories. Another study published online July 8th in Nature may provide hope for people who want to live longer but don't want to tightly control those calories. Researchers at the National Institute on Aging prolonged the lifespan of elderly mice, back to mice, by feeding the mice high doses of rapamycin. This is a drug commonly used to suppress the immune system of organ transplant recipients. The drug is the first molecular mimic of caloric restriction proven to extend lifespan in mammals. You may remember that I also mentioned the highly touted compound from red wine months ago called resveratrol. That is still being tested, but other studies have failed to prolong lifespan of mice on a normal diet with the compound. I guess that was too good to be true. Well, that's about all from me. Aloha and mahalo. As always, take care, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.